patriotism, faith, national unity, education, fiscal responsibility, civility, the values that define America. Fascinating stories and talks from America-loving patriots dedicated to preserving freedom, opportunity, and justice. Welcome to the Friends and Fellow Citizens Podcast. Everyone, and welcome to the Friends and Fellow Citizens Podcast, episode 116. I'm your host, Sherman Telosky. Thank you all so much for joining me for this month's interview episode. I hope you are all doing well. I've got a couple announcements for you before we get started. First, as usual, make sure to subscribe to Friends and Fellow Citizens if you haven't already. I'd also like to thank our Patreon supporters and their incredible dedication to this show. If you'd like to make a donation, even $5, a cup of coffee per month is a fantastic way to support the show. So I encourage you to check out our Patreon page. Even a donation as little as $5, the price of a cup of coffee would be a tremendous support for our program. As some of you may know, I started a brand new organization called the George Washington Institute in 2021. This is a small public speaking organization that I started because I wanted to integrate a lot of those features that we've been really discussing here on Friends and Fellow Citizens and opening that to a broader audience with speeches and other commitments, other interviews that I've done on other podcasts. And it used to be up to today, really just two entities. We had the George Washington Institute, GWI, with its own website and its own programs, and we have Friends and Fellow Citizens, which is kind of seen as like a second entity, but more like a partner organization. GWI would not be possible with all of your support and everything that we have accomplished with this podcast, and I do think that it is very much the conduit that's going to continue to drive these ideas about Washington's farewell address, about history and foreign policy, civics, education, all the topics that we've been covering, we want to really bring that to a broader audience. That is why I am announcing that today we will be bringing the Friends and Fellow Citizens podcast under the umbrella organization, the George Washington Institute. What that means is that it will not only be present on the George Washington Institute website, but it will be the primary destination for all podcast content. So I will be linking the georgewashingtoninstitute.org website link down in the show notes below. So that will be the new link to the full website, but I will also include the Buzzsprout link, Buzzsprout being the podcast host name, and that will be the main link to use to share Friends and Fellow Citizens, which I highly encourage all of you to do to your friends and family if they haven't listened to this podcast already. Though it's basically, the George Washington Institute is going to be that one-stop shop of all the products and all the services that we are going to be providing under George Washington Institute. Friends and Fellow Citizens at this point is going to be very much the center of GWI and what it is currently doing right now and what I want the GWI to be in the future. So welcome to the brand new world of GWI. And I know that this is going to be a really, really good change for the podcast. Nothing substantive changes, obviously, but it's going to be under a much broader umbrella. And it just makes sense for Friends and Fellow Citizens and GWI to be together under the same roof. And without further ado, let's get right into today's episode with our guest, Dr. Michael Green. Michael Green is an associate professor of history in the University of Nevada, Las Vegas' Department of History. He earned his BA and MA at UNLV and his PhD at Columbia University. He teaches history courses on 19th century America and on Nevada in Las Vegas for the History Department and the Honors College. His books on the Civil War era are Freedom, Union, and Power, Lincoln and His Party During the Civil War, Politics and America in Crisis, The Coming of the Civil War, and Lincoln and the Election of 1860. His works on Nevada include Las Vegas, A Centennial History, Nevada, A Journey of Discovery, a middle school textbook, and the oral history of a longtime Nevada attorney and politician, A Liberal Conscience, Ralph Denton, Nevadan. The University of Nevada Press published his college-level textbook, Nevada, A History of the Silver State, in 2015. Green is now working on several projects. He is writing A History of the Great Basin in the 20th Century for the University of Arizona Press and A History of Organized Crime in the 20th Century for Roman and Littlefield. He also is editing A Companion to Abraham Lincoln as part of the Wiley Blackwell series of historiography volumes. He edits the Wilbur S. Shepperson series on Nevada history for the University of Nevada Press and is a member of the editorial board for the press. He is a member of the board of directors for the Mob Museum. He is the director of Preserve Nevada and serves as executive director of the Pacific Coast branch of the American Historical Association. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I am very excited to welcome Dr. Michael Green to the podcast. Mike, thank you so much for coming on to our podcast today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Well, first of all, I just want to say we're just a couple of Nevadans talking on a podcast, and I'm super excited to get into some very Nevada-centric topics today because there's so much connection, I think, between our state and really U.S. history. And so I obviously wanted to find someone who I think could really speak a lot more in depth with some of this history. So, Mike, let's get right into it. You know, Nevada is one of, I think, the most interesting states that I know of. But it's kind of a bit of an eccentric start to it in the sense that really became a state in a very tough time, which I think is very symbolic of why we call it the Battleborn State. So can you walk us through just a bit of the early history of how Nevada really started entering what we know as the United States of today?
Well, it's funny because, yes, we are Battleborn statehood during the Civil War. And you begin to get settlement here, and by here I mean within the boundaries of present-day Nevada, especially in the Northwest, around Virginia City and that area, in the early 1850s. You have the discovery of the Comstock Lode in 1859, and at that time, most of Nevada, except for Clark County, Las Vegas, was part of Utah Territory, and there really wasn't much government in the area. And you might think, well, do a bunch of miners and ranchers and really need government that much? And the answer is they actually need to figure out where the mining claims are, where are the land boundaries, and so on. They do need some government. Utah wasn't really providing it. And people in the area had sought territorial status for a while, and here we have Nevada being caught up in international and national events. If we think of the 1850s as that period where there is this intense argument over slavery and the growth of slavery, creating a new territory out of what would be Nevada was very controversial. They just weren't going to do it if they could help it. Then comes the Comstock Lode discovery in 1859, then the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860. And before Lincoln took office, 7 southern states seceded from the Union. And when they seceded, their representatives and senators leave Congress. So there is now a much stronger northern contingent, and they decided to create 3 new territories. The others were Nebraska and Colorado. And they approved this on March 2nd, 1861. James Buchanan was leaving office in 2 days. And the bill did not mention slavery, which led some people to say, oh, see, they didn't care about slavery anyway. No. They knew Lincoln was going to be in charge of appointing territorial governor, judges, and so on, and he was going to appoint his people, members of his party who opposed the spread of slavery. And that's what he did. The territorial governor, James Nye, was a strongly anti-slavery politician from New York. With the continued growth of Nevada because of the mining discoveries and economic problems that resulted when either there was a little fall off in mining or a lack of investment, add in concerns about the territorial judiciary and the desire to have their own judges, their own politicians, and Nevadans began pushing for statehood. They actually broke the law. I know this is shocking to think that Nevadans would ever break the law. But technically, if you're in a territory, you don't have a constitutional convention until you have an enabling act from Congress, they went ahead anyway, and then defeated the Constitution because of political differences. In early 1864, Congress approved an enabling act, which then led to the ability to write a constitution, which they did. They sent the Constitution back to Washington, and it got lost. Not sure where it went. And they notified Governor Nye, who had it telegraphed, and it was the longest telegram up to that time. It cost about $4,300 to send it. It was that long. And they got it all transcribed, and it went to Lincoln, who signed off on October 31st, 1864. Which is why we used to joke that Nevada was the trick-or-treat to the nation. Where this is also kind of interesting, at least to me, as somebody who also studies Lincoln. There were people who said, well, no, Lincoln just signed off, it was no big deal. Lincoln was a politician to his toenails. And in his papers, there is a document where he has written down the states and their electoral votes and who he thinks is going to get them. And in 1864, he had calculated that he would get 117 electoral votes, and his opponent, George McClellan, would get 114. We have a longtime politician in Nevada, Governor, U.S. Senator Richard Bryan, who has a favorite phrase that there are two ways to run for office, unopposed or scared. And since Lincoln was not unopposed, he was scared. After Nevada statehood, someone else wrote 3 Nevada underneath to give him 120. So he is interested in these electoral votes. Then you have the 13th Amendment coming up before the House of Representatives, and every vote that counted. I mean, it barely passed in the end, and having another congressman from Nevada would help. And 2 senators from Nevada would additionally help with Lincoln pursuing the policies he wanted for Reconstruction. So we are really caught up in this maelstrom at the time over the issues related to the Civil War, and that leads to statehood. You sometimes hear about, oh, Lincoln wanted statehood because he wanted the gold and silver for the Union, and he already had it. This was a Union territory. He didn't need to worry about it. What he needed to worry about was maybe the Confederacy coming in and trying to steal it, but that wouldn't have mattered if Nevada became a state either. So we are part of a whole political and constitutional and, well, moral debate about slavery and the Union.
That's just so fascinating to hear. I mean, about Lincoln being that that political whiz and losing a constitution. Boy, that's why we have tracking devices now or tracking numbers. So we learned our lesson from we don't lose constitutions anymore with USPS, maybe.
It's funny because the big debate with the Constitution, one of the big debates, was how they would tax mining. And the leading attorney for the mining industry was a guy named William Morris Stewart, who goes on to be one of the first U.S. senators. And Stewart lost the battle over taxing mining. And he campaigned for the Constitution saying, well, it doesn't approach mining the right way, but when we get statehood, I'll be in charge and I'll fix it. And the reaction of voters was kind of, who are you? Who needs you? We'll vote this thing down. And in the end, the Constitution they passed really gave Stewart what he wanted, although he wasn't at that convention.
No, it's just fascinating. And obviously, James Nye County is named after that governor and Stewart. I believe there's a street in Carson. If it's Stewart, then we certainly remember him somehow with the street in Carson City.
Yes.
Well, I think what was shocking to me, I think, learning about this history is how Lincoln thought it was so close. And then when we see the results, you know, He was just a little off in the sense that he blew away.
Yeah, the electoral vote was what, 212-21. But I'm teaching a class on Lincoln right now, and I pointed out to the students that every 2 years from 1832 on, he either ran for office or was involved in elections, and you know, today, a lot of people look at politics and don't like it. And back then, it was a form of entertainment. if you think about the Lincoln-Douglas debates, they went for 3 hours. That's what people expected. Today, if we had the presidential debates, or you had a congressional debate in 2022 or a gubernatorial, and they said, okay, here are the rules. First person speaks for an hour, next person goes 90 minutes, and the last person gets 30 minutes to rebut, we'd all immediately click on the remote. But back then, they expected their money's worth for making the trip. So it was a lot bigger part of their lives than it is for us when we have so many other ways to amuse ourselves.
Really glad you brought up that point, Mike, because I feel like a lot of times we don't think a lot about politics as entertainment, at least as much as we like to praise, you know, certain or at least tell people about the kinds of virtues, the ideals that we want to have in democracy. There's just so many elements to the political world that we forget a lot of times, I think, about those kind of events. I'd be one of the first to be like Super Bowl tickets going to the Lincoln Douglas debates, probably.
Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Once said that politics is the best spectator sport. And then he added something like, it's also pretty good for participation.
That's true.
And I had a friend who was active in politics, didn't hold many offices. But he said, it's a great game. It should be fun. But it's okay to remember the stakes are enormous. And if you think about it, shouldn't we be enjoying what we do, even if the stakes are enormous? A surgeon doing life-saving surgery. I wouldn't call that fun, but for that surgeon, that's what that surgeon loves to do. And we should think of it that way.
And that's just, you almost read my mind, Mike, because that's just a perfect segue to get into this other bit of Nevada history, which is about gaming. And I guess gambling kind of turned into gaming.
I thought you were going to discuss my hypochondria after the medical reference. But no, gaming.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. I mean, gaming and really, it started with gambling, and then the name just started gaming because it sounds a lot more fun, I guess. And it sounds more kids appropriate. But since we're talking before the 60s, I think was around that time when they really started using the word gaming a lot. But let's look in a bit into the gambling world of Nevada, because this seems like everyone, when they think of Las Vegas or think of Nevada, they think of gambling. And it's just a really fascinating history. So let's look a bit at some of that illegal gambling that was probably going around a lot during.
No. This is an oddity of Nevada, that it was one of the few states where gambling was legal in the 19th century. And when the territorial legislature first met, Governor Nye said, I hope you will ban gambling. It is a vice. It is terrible. And the legislature largely ignored him. But the first governor, Henry Blaisdell, was a devout Methodist and opposed gambling. He was known as the coffee and chocolate governor because he wouldn't serve alcohol in the governor's mansion. And he vetoed two bills to legalize gambling, and they finally overrode him. And in 1869, gambling became legal in Nevada, and it remained legal in most of its forms until 1910, and that's the progressive era and moral reform and the whole notion of a regulatory state. And Nevada banned gambling, but not completely. And it gradually started working its way back in, so people were conducting illegal gambling games and so on. In the 1920s, when you also have prohibition, there's a wonderful photo of the Arizona Club, called the Queen of Block 16 in Las Vegas, because it was the most elaborate saloon. It had alcohol. It had rooms in the back for prostitutes. And all of that was illegal. And in this classic photo of the Arizona Club, standing in the middle of the saloon was the sheriff. He did not worry about enforcing what he considered a victimless crime, or you didn't bother anybody, we weren't going to bother you. And that tended to be the attitude for the most part in Nevada. And so there was some illegal gambling going on, as well as some very limited legal gambling, until in 1931, the state legislature passed a bill making gambling legal. And people always say, well, yeah, that's the final bill that made gambling legal. Well, in theory, they could pass a bill that would criminalize it again. They're not going to, nor should they. But there we are. And the interesting aspect of this is that there are every culture, every event, you might say, has an origin story. And the origin story for legal gambling was the guy who introduced the bill was a rancher from Humboldt County in rural Nevada who said, oh, they're going to do it anyway. I wanted to regulate it, et cetera. Well, the state didn't actually regulate it at first. It was left to the counties and the cities who did not have the budgets, the personnel to regulate it closely, nor did the state when it started regulating it. And it appears, thanks to research by a former director of the Nevada Historical Society, Eric Moody, that you really get the origins of legal gambling as part of a plan to attract investors. The idea being, let's get them to Nevada, cut the residency requirement for divorce to 6 weeks, that'll bring them here. Legalize gambling, that'll bring them here. And they'll see the place, love it, and want to put money into it. And if they don't, they visited, and we get some of their money and they go home. And of course, these turn into tourist economies in their own right. It isn't simply, oh, let's come there, we'll gamble a little bit while we look at buildings. They come here to gamble. And it ends up becoming the goose that lays the golden egg or the driver of Nevada's economy for the most part. And that was not the plan. But then again, I have an idol, the late Vin Scully, who used to love to say, if you want to make God smile, tell him your plans.
It's fascinating to see some of those parallels with nowadays. And when you look at the hospitality industry, and obviously that has diversified a lot since the gambling era. But I presume that really so much of what you describe, Mike, I think is very much part of what we understand, historically, even up to this present day, as some form of the culture of Nevada. This idea that it was this rugged like former territory, and I still consider in a playful way the Wild West as kind of encompassing Nevada and some other parts of the West. But one of the things that I was always fascinated about reading this history, the need to know the sheriff, know these people, know your neighbor, and all that because of this very, very tough desert environment. And so without this reliability between one another, in these communities with the harsh conditions of the mining, I can't remember the temperature down in those mines, but it's really high. It's not, I think it's probably 120 at least, probably more, but people couldn't even last 15 minutes.
There are these crazy numbers about how much ice a miner would go through in a day, maybe 100 pounds. There's a story of Ulysses Grant, after he was president, visiting the Comstock, going down in a mine, coming up and saying, well, now I don't have to go to hell because I know what it feels like. And yeah, there is this combination of individualism, misplaced ideas about individualism, and reliance on others. There's a lot of individualism. The prospector out on his own, sometimes her own, mining, the rancher who's got to be wary of cattle rustlers because they are on several acres and it's not easy to get to them and there are no telephones. And then, yes, knowing your neighbor, being prepared for such a contingency. And then the fact that you have a government that sets up having county sheriffs and city officials, and a federal government that passes legislation that's favorable to mining, favorable to ranching, helpful, beneficial, whatever term you want to use. And then ultimately, of course, the federal government being seen as this pain in the butt, interfering with all of the freedom they wanted to have. And I was recently interviewed about this, and I said that there was a comic strip years ago called Bloom County. And one of the characters, Opus the Penguin, decided to study how to become a farmer. And one of the requirements was to say the following two sentences without bursting out laughing. And it was, keep those goobers from Washington out of my business. Where's my federal subsidy check? And he couldn't do it. Yeah. And I like to say that the Americans oppose federal spending in 49 states. But if the time comes to cut, Nevadans are going to say, no, cut there or there, but not here. And that's just human nature, in all honesty. But in that way, Nevada's kind of a laboratory for the country. We are a large scale, small populous version of the rest of the country in a lot of ways, facing a lot of similar issues and people moving here either from within the U.S. or as immigrants. And in turn, having issues with government or with the need for government or with one another.
Having these debates, I think, is super healthy in a democracy, you know, having that active conversation about some of the things that you mentioned, Mike, about individualism, about the role of government, and something that we're definitely going to tie in at the end of this episode, because just to tie it all in. But let's move on a bit to the after 1931, after Governor Balzer signs the legislation. By the way, I'm curious to know how Nevada is going to celebrate 100 years of that legislation, 2031.
Yeah, I have heard of no preparations, and I'm kind of hoping I don't. They may ask historians, yeah. And we've got enough to do. Thank you.
Yes.
I have the funny feeling it'll come up.
Right. Lead up to 1931 with Nevada trying to find sources of revenue, especially running out of time, is of such a tough time in the 1930s with the Great Depression. So, Mike, tell us a little bit about after 1931, but more specifically, something a bit more organized, but not more lawful than what Nevada has produced over the last several decades. So tell us a little bit about how the mob starts forming and, I guess, placing its hold on this, not just Las Vegas, but really the state of Nevada generally.
You know, you get this period, really the 30s, where you do not see organized crime much at all, frankly. And you have small-time operations. These are not big casinos. They don't generate a lot of money. They make money, of course. Steve Wynn once said, if you want to make money in a casino, own it. That's how you get rich in a casino. And there are certain larger places that today, by our definition, would be about the equivalent of a boutique room. You say, oh, here's the Baccarat room, or something like that today. And the Baccarat room today is bigger than the whole casino then. And there were professional operators, and some with some serious connections. In Las Vegas, a good example is the Cornero brothers, who opened the Meadows in 1931. Tony joined them after he got out of prison. And in California, they had been very involved in bootlegging, in prostitution, gambling, all the things you associate with organized crime. They weren't very successful at the time. And they leave. Tony Cornero would come back later. And there isn't a lot happening in terms of organized crime interest. Now, in the mid to late 30s, the state of California had a fairly new attorney general, Earl Warren, yes, later the chief justice, and a newly elected mayor of Los Angeles, Fletcher Bowron, who wanted to get rid of a lot of the gamblers. Warren concentrated on the cruise ships that operated off the California coast, and Bowron on the city of Los Angeles. And I used to say, well, Bowron was this reformer, et cetera, et cetera. And a little old lady came up to me, and this was more than 20 years ago, and she said, young man, Bowron was trying to get rid of the illegal casinos that competed with the ones he ran. Now, is that true? I don't know. And that's one of the difficulties of this kind of history. You don't write down your illegal activities if you have any brains.
Right.
But as they were shutting people down, what's the logical thing to do from Southern California if you want to be in gambling? You go up the highway to Las Vegas. One major exception, Bill Hara, who went to Reno, but ultimately his corporation came to Las Vegas. Some of them were not connected at all to organized crime. Sam Boyd was a dealer on one of the boats, and he went to Hawaii first, came back, worked his way up, and Boyd Gaming is now a major corporation in the industry. Marion Hicks ran a cruise ship, had to shut it down, came up to Las Vegas, ended up with the El Cortez and then the Thunderbird, and interestingly, both of those places ended up associated with Meyer Lansky. So does that mean that Hicks was a front man in the first place? We don't know for sure. But it's around 1940 that you begin to see more serious interest on the part of organized crime in Las Vegas. It's partly to find revenue streams, gambling itself being profitable, skimming off the top of the profits, and there's a race wire concession operating out of here. And if you control that, then all of the people betting on horse racing across the country have to deal with you. And that combination in Las Vegas ends up attracting people associated with Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. Siegel actually had come here and was here for the race wire, though he'd already made an investment in a casino here. He tried to buy the first hotel on the strip, the El Rancho Vegas, and the owner, Tom Hull, said the people of Las Vegas have been too good to me to sell to someone like Siegel. Well, really? And he lived to tell about it, which is kind of impressive. And it's in the 40s then that Siegel and his partners end up buying the El Cortez downtown. It's profitable. And they look out to the strip where a Hollywood businessman, Billy Wilkerson, has started building the Flamingo, end up taking that over when Wilkerson runs out of money. And that ends up being the first truly mob-owned and controlled hotel casino here, so far as we know. There's some evidence that there were some people hanging around Reno at about the same time as well. We're not excluding Reno from the conversation, but Las Vegas became the main city for this. And one of the reasons is that Reno was an older community, really debating how important casinos should be. And in Las Vegas, a newer community that saw itself more on the cusp of economic risk, it was more along the lines of, oh, things are more open here. Come on in. The water's fine. And in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, organized crime interests built most of the major hotel casinos on the strip and controlled several of them downtown. The question then becomes, how organized is organized crime? And the answer is there's a lot of organization to it, but there are some people who might operate a little more on the periphery, or in certain cases, as one of the owners of the Sahara once said, we just knew them, but we weren't among them. And the Sahara was an example of a hotel casino that was not, so far as we know, mob connected.
There's a bit of a fun fact that I believe it's in your bio, which I left out, but I think it's something that I think has a connection there. Tell us why Las Vegas is not in Las Vegas.
So the city limits of Las Vegas, if you're going south, extend to Sahara Avenue. And then it is county land, meaning the Las Vegas Strip is not in Las Vegas. And what happened, Tom Hull, when he built the El Rancho Vegas, wanted to be outside the city limits to avoid certain taxes and fees, but in fact the city provided some services to his hotel, to the El Rancho, to the Hotel Last Frontier when it opened the next year. And the city kind of got fed up. We're not getting your taxes and fees. And looked into annexation. And as the strip grew, this became more of a concern. So these supposed mob killers who were running these casinos went to the legislature and they got the okay for the creation of unincorporated townships. The county commission agreed. And they created two unincorporated townships in the early 50s, Paradise Township and Winchester Township. There are now a couple of others, and the strip is for the most part in Paradise. So I've always wondered why Las Vegas doesn't do more of an ad campaign. Come to Paradise, you know. And for that reason, while the city of Las Vegas derives some benefit from all this, it in fact does not get directly the taxes and fees that the casinos must pay in operating. The state gets its share, the county gets its share. And it leads to an oddity of politics. This is the only state I know of where members of the legislature would leave the legislature to serve on a county commission. And they did it because the Clark County Commission has Paradise Township within it. It's the government entity closest to the strip. That's where the action is. And there's more activity, there's more money, there are more important decisions, perhaps. I could debate that. But so that's how we come out with the fact that the strip itself is not in Las Vegas. And since I live in Paradise Township, but my mailing address is Las Vegas, Nevada, I live in Las Vegas, but I don't live in Las Vegas. Now, for what it's worth, Oscar Goodman, when he was mayor, he would always go down to the strip on New Year's Eve. And he said, you know, 250,000 people don't know I'm their mayor. And they don't know why I'm not their mayor. So, you know, I just go down there and have a good time.
It's just, that's wonderful, Mike. And it's always one of those fun facts that you have to tell people. I wonder how many minds have been twisted into pretzels of you tell them, say, I'm in Las Vegas, but I'm not in Las Vegas. What's going on here? Then you can tell that story.
Well, and I've done talks to groups that were on the strip, and I've said, by the way, have you left your hotel? And they'll say, no. I said, well, you haven't been to Las Vegas yet. And that would shake them up a bit.
It sums up a lot of the history of Nevada. It's like, oh, you thought it was this, but it's not. It's not really that, is it?
Exactly.
I was thinking about that famous saying, you know, as people say, Vegas is not built on winners. Well, one of those people or entities that wasn't a winner was the city of Las Vegas losing out on this.
It did. And yet this is kind of interesting that the master plan community of Summerlin is in the city of Las Vegas. And it extends in numerous directions, and it's been very successful and everything. And the city is very happy about that. Of course, they also have downtown and the casinos there and some neighborhood casinos. But Summerlin land was owned by Howard Hughes. And there was an attorney here, Sam Lionel, who died not long ago at the age of 103 and practiced until he was 100. And he was the attorney for Hughes in the early 60s. And they said, the city controls our land. We want to be free of the city. So Lionel did the legal work to get them out of the city. And 25 years later, they decided to develop the land and came to him and said, we'd like you to get annexed by the city so we can have help from the city. And Lionel said, you know, they could have saved some trouble for themselves 25 years before.
I think sometime in the 70s, was there another attempt by the city? And I think the Nevada Supreme Court came in and kind of acted like the adult in the room. It's like, no, you can't. This is not your land.
There have been several attempts over the years, and the law involving the unincorporated township stipulates that the township can be annexed only by a vote of its residents. So if you live in Paradise Township, as I do, and we vote that we want to be part of the city of Las Vegas, okay. But otherwise, it doesn't happen. And there were some city managers who were kind of the Pac-Men of their time, trying to gobble up whatever they could. And so there were some attempts to get some land, and at times it worked. At other times it didn't, because you just couldn't get into the township or take something from another city.
Yes, and now it's the debate in in Nevada politics, and I guess a little bit of federal politics is on lands bills now, just dealing with the federal government, going back to, you know, some of the things that you mentioned about that weird relationship. It's a weird relationship when the federal government owns 85% of your land, and there's a number of people like, I might not want to deal with these kinds of people all the time.
Ideally not. And what this goes back to is, if you will, the bargain Nevada had to make. That is what the federal government required, that Nevada had to concede any land that did not already get claimed to the federal government. And there are people who then say, well, it's our land, you know, we should take it back. Well, on the one hand, that land came to the U.S. thanks to its victory in the Mexican-American War. And Nevada itself did not exist. It was federal land, and the federal government decided to create a territory and then a state out of it. So it was never Nevada's land. On the other hand, in the Constitution, there is something called the Equal Footing Doctrine. And any new state is seen as being on equal footing with the original 13. And at the time, 14th state is going to come in, well, are we the stepchild or what? No, you're equal. It just depends on your population and how much power your senators might accrue and what happens with your economy. But on the face of it, you're equal. And there are Nevadans who would say, well, we can't be equal when 85% of our potential property tax base is unavailable to us. The people who say that tend to oppose property taxes. So I'm not too sure what they do with the taxes if they got them or had the opportunity. But it's also the case that thanks to the combination of tourism and mining, Nevada has done pretty well economically. And the question is, what do we do with the revenue, and do we tax them enough? And that's part of the dispute as well.
Fascinating. And I think this is a good lead up to overall, how has the gaming industry in Nevada changed since the mob era into what we know about Nevada's gaming industry today?
It was a tough slog to get rid of the mob. And it really isn't completed until the 80s. And the comparison, I mean, there are a few ways you can approach it. One of them is, if you look at the smallest major hotels on the Strip, they are bigger than the biggest hotels the mob built. Substantially bigger. The mob was behind the Stardust. It opened in 1958 with about 1,000 rooms. And oh my God, this is huge! And of course, today, 1,000 rooms, that's about 20% of the MGM Grand. So we're talking about significant changes in scale. When the Desert Inn opened, they were very excited that their casino was 2,400 square feet. It was huge. And today, that looks like, you know, just a little corner where you have these 100,000 square foot casinos or whatever. And that's a big difference, because organized crime had a lot of money, but not easy access to significant capital for investment. And the modern builders do. It's worth noting that modern investors from Wall Street weren't really interested until the mid-90s. Steve Wynn, when he built the Mirage, financed it on junk bonds from Michael Milken. They were not yet ready to say, oh, Las Vegas is a good investment. So size. And with the growth of the size of the casinos comes this feeling that it's so much less personal. Everybody knew your name. You could get a comp so easily. Everything was cheaper, etc. And there is some truth to those statements, but there's also some myth or misplaced nostalgia. As an example, everybody knew your name. Well, yeah, in a small casino, it's pretty easy to know your name. Casino that's that much bigger, it's harder to know your name. However, if you belong to a players club and you insert that card, they know your name if you're gambling. And they know your name. And even then, it isn't as if everybody who walked in suddenly had reached the Big Rock Candy Mountain and everybody was going to get freebies left and right. There were a lot of freebies. And that certainly has changed, although a big gambler is still going to get special deals. And there are some deals available. And when you say, well, things are more expensive, I think if we calculate for inflation, generally, they are some degrees less expensive than people realize. But what do you get? If you look at photos of the rooms at the Flamingo in the 40s, the Sands in the 50s, elite hotel casinos, they are not luxurious in the way today's rooms are, period. At the same time, they didn't want you staying in the room. Today, you stay in the room, you use the bar, costs money. You get something off the TV, costs money, so on and so forth. Back then, no, head for the casino. Now, a big change is for the mob, the casino was really all that mattered. Everything else would be fairly cheap because they knew they'd beat you at the tables. That's actually simple probability. But now it is, and I don't say it sarcastically, a tourist experience because you are paying for all these other things. Now, you may go to an arena and see a concert, and you're going to pay a lot more. You also might have a different experience than the intimacy of the older showroom and lounge. And there's something to be said for both. But Frank Sinatra said when he first started playing Las Vegas, for $6, you got filet mignon and me. You got a dinner for $6 and you got a filet mignon. Well, that's nice. At the same time, $6 in 1951 probably calculates to a pretty good amount today. Let's talk about that filet mignon. I grew up here. And when I was growing up here, you had a section of town or two where there was some Chinese food, but it was almost all Chinese food. And there were areas where you would find Mexican food. Did you find the diversity that you find today? No. Las Vegas is a foodie paradise today. You pay more, but you get more. I had a longtime casino operator here tell me Las Vegas could not offer the kinds of food other places could, partly because of technology. How do you get the great seafood here without some spoiling on the way? And so eventually, this was really the work of the people behind the Forum shops at Caesars. They asked Wolfgang Puck to come in and open a restaurant, and he did in the mid-90s, and this is the arrival of the celebrity chef. And you're talking about a wholly different approach to dining than there used to be. I grew up with $1.99 buffets, and as a little fat kid, I thought it was great. But probably my cholesterol level might be a little better today if I hadn't done that. So there are these evolutions, if you will, and some of the evolutions we think we've seen are not really that different. And I'll give you an example of this. When Sinatra played here in the 50s, it wasn't just Sinatra. There'd be a comedian. There were, as they were called, showgirls. There might be dancers and so on. And then today we have Cirque du Soleil, which offers a lot of the things the showrooms offered then. Higher tech, different approaches, but there are a lot of similarities if you think about it. The cost, well, again, calibrate for inflation. They tend not to have a Sinatra, but then again, I don't think we've had the Sinatra Cirque show yet. We've had the Beatles and Elvis and Michael Jackson. We don't have them personally anymore for what are unfortunate reasons, but there they are. But you can still get their music. And entertainment itself has changed. The Grammy Awards were recent, and you listen to the performers, and you look at the performers, and there are differences, some of which are wonderful, the diversity, the talent, and some of which, when you see Harry Styles in a jumpsuit on the red carpet And you think, really? Okay. That's different. More power to Harry, but Sinatra never wore a jumpsuit like that at the Grammys. Well, maybe it's better and maybe it's not.
Time to start digging through the archives of Frank Sinatra in a jumpsuit.
I don't know that I want to see him in that jumpsuit.
You mentioned the tourist experience. I'll never forget the first time I went to Vegas. This was back in 2021. And I remember just you're on the strip, and as someone who loves studying political science and politics and all that, I felt like as far away from DC, further away from DC as Alaska is from DC, because you are in this environment where people are walking around. I don't think a lot of them really know what's going on. They're just looking around and walking in and out of the casinos or going to a show, watching the Raiders or whatever it is that they want to do. And it really has become that entertainment capital. It's like any kind of entertainment you can imagine, whether it's through food, through music, through sports now, which is itself a whole other category. But it's really remarkable to see that transformation, but transformation based on some common roots there.
It is. And I think back to my late father, who first came here in the 50s to visit and had to wear a necktie to the showroom. You were expected to dress up. Well, I think we have become more casual as a society, and Las Vegas reflects that. And yes, it is more truly an entertainment capital. An example of this is that the hotels might have a nightclub that featured dancing and a lounge act. And today, the nightclub means something different. And something like 7 of the 10 most profitable nightclubs in the world are on the Las Vegas Strip. Or some improbable number. And a couple of the shouldn't call them old timers, they've been around a while though, but they have been involved with the Strip a long time, and they'll kind of look at this and say, I don't get it. I'm glad it's working out for us, but I don't get it. And part of this goes back to a story about Elvis. Elvis performed at the International, later the Hilton, and now the Westgate, and was an incredible success. The first time he performed in Las Vegas was in 1956 on a bill at the Frontier Hotel, and he was part of a bill, so it's hard to judge Elvis, but people did not get incredibly excited about him. One of the reasons is that he was 21 years old. He was something totally different, with swiveling hips and this different beat and so on. And that was not the audience. And by the time he came back, he was in his 30s, so were his fans. And they were going to come to Las Vegas. And it struck me when the Palms opened in 2001, and they had buffet coupons, which certainly appealed to my father, but would appeal probably to an older audience. But they also were very proud of being connected to MTV and having the Real World suite and so on. And so they're learning to cater to very different markets, depending on the market and who's out there. In the 90s, there was a period where Las Vegas marketed itself as a family destination. But there were always things to do here for families. The question was whether they advertised them. So, as a longtime Las Vegas resident put it in an ad some years ago, image is everything. For those who don't know, that's Andre Agassi.
So many different pieces coming together. I mean, we've covered so many different elements of Nevada history, you know, even going down to Las Vegas history. But I'm really excited about what's new coming up for Las Vegas and for Nevada, because when we look back at this history, we see all the different players and characters, and whatever, from losing constitutions to the mob to Elvis. And you mentioned, Mike, about how I guess there's a lot of that in Vegas, where you see something, it's like, I don't get it, but it works. I'm glad to see, it's like with Elvis now getting people married at the Graceland wedding chapel somewhere. It's like, well, I don't get it, but Hey, Elvis found a new job in Las Vegas now.
He came back from Kalamazoo.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what your interests or inclinations are. And if you think about major cities that cater to tourists, New York, I think that's a good choice, Miami, San Francisco, Los Angeles, there is a great variety of things you might do. And at one time, Las Vegas, well, the state of Nevada, had a monopoly on gambling, legally, that is. And in 78, New Jersey allowed gambling in Atlantic City. And suddenly, this market disappears. People back there might come to Las Vegas, but if they were making four trips a year before, now they're going to make one. And as gambling itself has expanded, riverboats, lotteries, Indian reservations, you name it, Las Vegas had to adapt. And the adaptation was to emphasize everything else. And this was brought home to me when I asked Alan Feldman to speak to a Nevada history class I was teaching. Alan Feldman spent close to three decades doing the marketing first for Wynn Resorts and then for MGM Resorts. And he put up a chart that showed that when the Mirage opened, two-thirds of the revenue came from gambling and a third from everything else. And by the time Alan left the business, he's now with the International Gaming Institute at UNLV, it had reversed, it had flipped. One-third gambling, two-thirds everything else. Which, frankly, is a better economic basis for Las Vegas.
The adaptation, I think, of Las Vegas is, I think it's a great lesson for other cities, too. Because when you see how a city can adapt, can be, in many ways, I think, a lot of people say that the American Revolution was an experiment. I'd say Las Vegas is one of the most interesting experiments that people can ever imagine.
Well, it is. And there was a Supreme Court Justice, Louis Brandeis, I believe, who referred to states as laboratories of democracy. The states have some room to experiment where the federal government might not. Now, when Nevada experimented with legal gambling, 47 other states, since there were 48 at the time, essentially said that this is a totally immoral place. The people who live there have horns. They're the devil incarnate, etc. The experiment, though, ended up working in a lot of ways. There were ways in which it didn't work, if you think about organized crime and other sociological problems, problem gambling, etc. But yes, it's a great experiment. And I'll give you one that has nothing to do with gambling. Las Vegas had an underground water supply and managed to use it up, which required Nevada to draw on its allotment of Colorado River water from the Colorado River Compact signed when they were planning the construction of Hoover Dam. Now, of course, Lake Mead has dropped precipitously. There are drought conditions in the upper Colorado that mean we're not getting the water we used to get. Other people around the world, not just the U.S., the world, come to Las Vegas to study its water conservation measures. Las Vegas, broadly speaking, the metropolitan area, got out in front as much as it could. There were areas where it could have gone farther, and there were areas it couldn't do anything. But in terms of saying, new developments don't get lawns, we're going to pay you to replace your lawns, etc., Las Vegas did some things to combat the problem. It might be a lot harder to do at the national or even state level. But this was the experiment that in some ways has worked. Now we need to see if there really is enough water.
And when it comes to really looking back at the big picture, I mean, that's a great example too. I mean, we think about the environment, about kind of the future of water conservation. that really is, again, another laboratory in that sense. And Mike, you mentioned the International Gaming Institute, and I'd like to ask you, just to tie in a bit about with all the history we've covered so far of Nevada, tell us a bit about what IGI does at UNLV, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and why you think gaming history is an important topic to study, not just in the state of Nevada, but really as part of who we are as the United States of America.
I'll start with the International Gaming Institute, and it's related to the fact that UNLV developed a hotel college, now called a hospitality college, that was certainly one of the best in the country, and we at UNLV would say the best, in part because we have the best lab. We've got a lab just a couple of miles from campus, and it made sense to study the industry itself in more depth. And so over the years, the International Gaming Institute has expanded. Brett Abarbanel is now the executive director. Her predecessor, Bo Bernhard, built it from a staff of 2 to 36 people, I believe. And I mentioned Alan Feldman, who concentrates on problem gambling, but they brought in former gaming control regulators who would help study how do you regulate the industry. And I have spoken to groups that come in for the college or for IGI who are trying to figure out, okay, we're Australia. How do we do this? Or how does gambling develop? And they want some history. How did Las Vegas get to where Las Vegas is? It doesn't mean it's going to work for other places, but you know, all good ideas are worth stealing. Let's face it. And what's worked here is worth stealing. And so IGI does everything from contracted research, I guess you'd call it, people reach out to them, to holding seminars, workshops, conferences. And every 3 years, there is a major conference on gambling and risk-taking, as it's called, that really started with Bill Edington, who was in economics at UNR, and really did more than anyone else to promote the scholarly study of gambling. And Bo continued that tradition, Brett's continuing that tradition, and the people who work with them. And they've always had some interest in history, but it was kind of funny. During the pandemic, they wanted to do something online, and they asked me to do like a weekly gambling history program. It would be a trivia question, and then I'd explain the answer. And I sat down in my living room with the computer and recorded myself and sent it in. And it's a reminder that, you know, history matters. You have to study it. And if you don't study it, you're in trouble. And I'll approach it this way. If I go to the doctor's office because I am having, I don't know, I have the sniffles, they want to know my medical history. They need to know it. You take your car in to be repaired. What's the problem? Well, they need to know the car's history. And so that's sort of my evangelical side, you might say. And Bo made this point, actually, at a conference we attended, and he's made it in other places, and it's a great point, that Houston became known as a kind of epicenter for oil. Not necessarily that you find oil wells in downtown Houston, but you have headquarters, you have groups studying it, figuring out the geology, the economics, the history, and so on. And that's what Las Vegas should be and is for gambling and entertainment, I think, more broadly. And IGI is a major contributor to that, and it includes everything from a sociology of gaming class that our sociology department offers to gaming history classes that my department offers. So there are all kinds of ways to study this that I think are beneficial to the industry and to society itself that go well beyond the industry. How do we get to where we are? Well, guess what? That's history.
I hope that, you know, other states, especially those who have legalized gambling in some way, my concern is that a lot of them don't know about the history of gaming and maybe not understanding some of the ways that Las Vegas has been able to evolve and be able to put its standards. I guess that's more, you know, Nevada Gaming Commission, Gaming Control Board. But I think the enforcement and all that, especially nowadays, that is going to be a really tough challenge for those states that don't know how to proceed. So I'm hopeful that maybe perhaps in the future you'll have some more audiences coming from states that you never thought would would come, but for a class on gaming history. But I would say they better know it. They better know it, or they risk maybe repeating certain mistakes in the past.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's kind of pat, trite, whatever term you want to use, although I like to point out to students, cliches become cliches because they're true. So we keep using them, that if you don't know the past, you're condemned to repeat it. Well, things change. I could make a case for you that the most significant moment in the history of gambling involved Alan Turing in England with computers, because the computer has completely changed the industry. A good example of this. It used to be slot machines were a loss leader. They were considered in those days something to amuse women while their husbands were at the crap table. And now, there's the central part of the casino. The tables still matter, but the fact is that the machines have become incredibly important. A strong profit center in their own right. And was it nearly so interesting when you pulled a lever and it went cherry, cherry, lemon? No, it was a lot less exciting. And Las Vegas tries to provide excitement in assorted forms. And sometimes it's exciting, and to some people it might not be exciting, so ideally they find something else to excite them. Which also may reflect the fact that NASCAR has been having a race here for years, a couple of races, other things going on. And now Formula One is bringing a Grand Prix to the Strip. I thought that it was tough enough to drive on the Strip. Now it's really going to get tough. Don't take on those people.
November's not going to be as quiet as in the past.
No. But then again, the following February, the Super Bowl. And if you really want to ponder how the world has changed, in 1963, the NFL commissioner suspended two very prominent players for gambling. About 20 years ago, the Convention and Visitors Authority wanted to advertise on the Super Bowl, and the NFL wouldn't let them. And they frowned on it when announcers, and I think Brent Musburger and Al Michaels were the two most prominent ones, would make oblique references to the spread. And now, Las Vegas has the Raiders, is getting the Super Bowl, the NCAA championship a few years later. These are the kinds of things that once upon a time were impossible to imagine. But gambling itself is viewed so much differently now, and with it, Las Vegas.
All right, everyone, that'll wrap up part one of our conversation with Dr. Michael Green from UNLV. Thank you all so much for listening to this part of the episode 116. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Coming up next, a lot more about President Abraham Lincoln and the state of Nevada. So click on the link down in the show notes below. Part two is coming up next.